It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll visit a unique archaeological site in Wisconsin and find out how the public is getting involved in solving mysteries there.
First, Senator Ted Cruz's Republican convention speech last night stirred up the crowd, and he pointedly refused to endorse GOP nominee Donald Trump.
And to those listening, please, don't stay home in November. If you love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
This morning at a breakfast meeting with the Texas delegation, Cruz defended his speech, saying he was not going to, quote, act like a servile puppy dog, end quote, in the face of past personal attacks on his family by the Trump campaign.
Some political observers see Cruz's move as cementing his future political career. Others see it as political suicide.
With us now is Katie Zesma, Washington Post national political correspondent covering the 2016 presidential election. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, he had a few sentences there that started with vote for, and he didn't end any of them with Donald Trump. And that seems to have gotten the crowd, part of it anyway, really pretty upset.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is a convention to nominate Donald Trump as the president of the United States. So a lot of people were thinking that Ted Cruz, who lost to Trump, would go up there and agree with the people who were there that Donald Trump should be nominated as the president, and he did not. It made a lot of people angry. It made various prominent supporters angry as well. Phil Robertson, who is a star of Duck Dynasty, who went around the country for Cruz's presidential campaign, told him to swallow his pride. Their prominent political supporters also said that they were not pleased with Cruz. And most strikingly was a delegation breakfast where Cruz was heckled by his own constituents, by his own delegation. He came in and he said, I recognize there are some folks who aren't happy with me. And this woman, yelled, that's right. And another man held up a sign that said Clinton Cruz 2020. So a lot of people are not happy with Senator Cruz right now.
Now, this isn't something we see in conventions these days. Once upon a time, there was actual drama at political conventions. These tend to be more choreographed, stage managed, rah-rah events. This isn't the kind of thing we usually are accustomed to seeing in conventions these days, is it?
No, it's definitely not. It's definitely not. To have a speaker who was running for president up until about 3 months ago, booed to the point of where people could barely hear him on the convention floor, that I think that may be unprecedented. It really does not happen. These things are usually very scripted, very state events, and that was not it. What happened last night.
So the big message of the convention so far has been trying to emphasize the idea of party unity. And that's what a lot of the speakers have talked about, unity against Hillary Clinton, if nothing else. How much did that spoil that message in the public eye for this convention?
Well, in some ways it was spoiled to begin with, because there are a number of delegates there who don't like Trump, who don't necessarily want him to be to be president. There was talk about some delegates trying to interrupt the process, and that kind of hung over the convention. It did actually happen. The stop Trump movement never really got off the ground at the convention, so this was kind of hanging in the air the entire time. And in Cruz's speech, definitely, really threatened further divisions in the party that's struggling to unite behind its nominee.
Let's talk about what this means for Ted Cruz in the future. He's the kind of guy who might run for president again. And there's been talk, this is a brilliant move, separating himself from what might be a big Trump fiasco. Other people saying this is it. It's career suicide. If you don't support the party, the party's not going to support you next time around. What kind of talk are you hearing?
Well, I covered Cruz's campaign for 14 months, and this to me looks like he's casting far beyond November. He has a re-election in 2018, and he asked his campaign manager if he's worried that this could hurt him, and he said, either you run scared or you don't run at all. They're going to run, and he's also looking toward 2020 for sure. Cruz is always someone who has tried to buck the establishment. He led things that contributed to the government shutdown in 2013, trying to block funding for Obamacare. He kind of uses that as a point of pride. And I think this as well, he's bucking party leaders, he's bucking party orthodoxy, and I think, this we'll expect to see him use this in the future as well.
We'll leave it there for now. Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Katie Zesma. She's a Washington Post national political correspondent. We'll have more on some of the Wisconsin reaction, Wisconsin delegate reaction with Sean Johnson later on in the show. An ongoing project at the Aztalan State Park in Jefferson County is trying to solve mysteries about the people who lived there hundreds of years ago while bringing the public and local school kids on board to learn how this kind of work gets done.
Cecil Schrader joins us now in the studio. She's professor of anthropology at UW-Madison and a leader of the project at Aztalan, supported by a recent Baldwin grant. Cecil, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation to join you.
Well, you've written that Aztalan was a diverse community bringing together a couple of different cultural groups. Who are the people of Aztalan?
They are groups that archaeologists call Late Woodland and Mississippian, and we have a lot of difficulty connecting them with specific descendant communities or tribes that live in the area today, but probably multiple tribes that lived in the area were related to the Late Woodland peoples. Many of the descendant communities related to the Mississippian peoples that lived at the site today live in the southeast, groups like the Creek and the Choctaw, and some Siouan-speaking groups on the Great Plains. And so we think that these two different groups, we see them archaeologically on the basis of different kinds of pottery that they made. They had different technologies for making pottery and different styles that they adopted in the kinds of vessels that they made. They built their houses in different ways as well. And so those are the things that we can access as archaeologists, and we look at those to try and understand something about the behaviors that brought these people together in one location in a way that seems to have been peaceful. So two very different cultural groups, we might call them ethnic groups today, found a way to coexist at this site for several generations.
We'll look into them a little bit more. I wanted to look at the people there today. You're bringing in kind of a diverse group of people to work on and visit these sites at Aztalan. Who have you been reaching out to bring them up close to this work?
Well, that's such a wonderful question. My collaborator, Kelly Tyrell, who is a science writer with UW-Madison, and I have been reaching out to local middle school teachers in Fort Atkinson in particular, and we've talked to some in the Kettle Moraine School District, Milwaukee, areas of the state that maybe don't get as many opportunities to work directly with UW-Madison. And those teachers were really excited about the way this project will be able to draw middle school students into an interdisciplinary study of the past, because the work that we do integrates multiple kinds of skill sets and disciplines. It integrates math skills, history, social studies, art, map making, writing, and, you know, students in middle school have different strengths in these areas, and we think by bringing them together as group learners as part of this project, we'll get them really engaged and allow them to excel in the areas that they have talents and learn more about other areas.
Why did you decide to go with middle school students instead of high school students who might have a little more educational road beneath the tires?
In part, we made that decision because of Act 31, which requires that a certain amount of Native American history be taught at particular benchmark moments in the K-12 process. And middle school students have units on Native American history in the state. And the lesson plans that are available for them to work with really focus on the colonial era and more recent issues that affect Native Americans. And they have limited amounts of curricular materials that deal with the deep, deep history of Native American occupation of this site that goes back more than 12,000 years. And so we really wanted to help augment the kinds of materials that were available.
And you also had public days at the site. I understand you're done working on the site for the season, which is probably okay on a hot day like today. But what happened to these public days?
So on the public days, visitors came. We had opportunities for them to help the students sift through the soil that we were excavating. We excavate in particular areas of the site that we've identified ahead of time using certain technologies like ground-penetrating radar and magnetic resistivity, electrical conductivity techniques. And those help us identify places that show lots of soil disturbance in the past. And so we know that those are places where people in ancient times excavated down into the soil to create semi-subterranean houses that would be a little bit cooler on a day like today, a little bit warmer in the winter than would be if they just sort of set them on the ground surface. So we know that we're excavating in areas that are going to be really interesting and rich with information about daily life, that are going to have the garbage that was thrown away, the trash from meals, from, you know, having broken some of their dishes. And so the public was able to help us sift this soil, which is the way we really find things. We find some things as we're excavating with shovels and with sharpened trowels, but a lot of materials we sift all the soil, so we make sure we find everything that's bigger like than a quarter of an inch in size. And it's often those small things that are the most interesting and informative about past behaviors.
How much training do you have to give the public, whether it's a middle school kid or a grown-up, about how to work on a site like this? Because I imagine part of the danger would be you find something that could be kind of priceless and oops, you've whacked it or something.
A lot of what we look at is really fragile. And so the undergraduate students who were part of the project, part of the field work this summer, would work with members of the public for, you know, maybe 10 minutes or so on screening soil and showing them what things look like. So they would see, this is a piece of pottery. And then the kids would say, oh, it looked just like dirt to me, or just like soil to me. And then they'd go, but then they'd look at it and they'd go, I see the difference now. So you'd help them start to recognize what things look like. So we would do some of that. The actual process of excavation is much more, it involves a lot of skills and physical strength that takes a longer time to build up. Our undergraduates take, a couple of weeks before they really have the comfort level at doing the careful excavation. That takes longer to provide training on.
Now, you are doing this as part of a Baldwin grant, I understand. Mm-hmm. And we've talked to a past recipient of that about a public archaeology project in Trempealeau that's bringing the locals there on board. Is this a new way of thinking about archaeology? It's not just something that the experts are doing. It's really sharing with the local community as part of the project?
I think that's always been part of archaeology. There's just something about archaeology that is really intriguing to people. There's something about the tangible nature of touching the past and learning about the past in your own backyard that just people naturally gravitate to those kinds of things. And so there's long been a relationship between archaeologists and the public. But I think what's really expanded over the last 20 years or so is connecting with school children directly. And really, my colleague who's doing the Trempealeau project, Danielle Benden, has also been working on developing some curricular materials for local school children. Just really trying to get kids invested in the history that's in their own place, in their own community. And it gives them a greater sense of belonging to that community when they have an understanding of its place.
What kinds of things have you heard from people when they do sort of get that little jolt that I'm holding something that is ancient in my hand here?
Oh, they usually are, it's usually, this is so cool. And or just sort of gasps of like, really? I'm only 10 years old. I can't believe this is so much older than me. And there's also, a lot of what we find is broken. We're digging through the trash of old people, of ancient people. And the broken things, it's difficult sometimes for the students and the public to visualize what that object might have looked like in its original form. And so we try to have pictures out there or have larger pieces of materials that are part of the teaching collection that we have at the university to help them get a better sense of what something looked like. And we talk about the technology, particularly with pottery, because every school kid has had to do that, multiple lessons in building pottery by the coil method. And that's the method, primary method, that was used to make the pottery that we work with. And so it's really easy to get them to start thinking like, it was made just the same way I did, but look at how much finer this old piece is.
Talking to UW-Madison anthropology professor Cecil Schrader, looking at Aztalan, the archaeological site there. The people who are investigating, learning about it today, including middle school students from around Wisconsin, and the people who lived there in the past. And I want to turn more to the past now, Cecil. Part of what you want to do in that area is help bust some myths about Aztalan. And there are a lot of them that I wasn't familiar with.
There are a lot of myths about Aztalan. Probably the biggest one has to do with its name. The name is a Mexican name. It's derived from the Aztec name for their ancestral home that they call Aztlan. And when the site was discovered in the early 1800s, mid-1830s, there was a bestseller kind of book out at that time, which was Baron Alexander von Humboldt's Travels Through Central and South America. And in that volume, he had lavish illustrations of pyramids that were made of stone. But when this Nathaniel Heyer, this person who wrote about the site in 1836, when he saw the earthen mounds at Aztalan, they reminded him of these illustrations of the stone pyramids that he had seen. And he'd read in that book how the Aztecs recounted that their ancestral home lay at the 40th parallel north. And this is kind of close to the 40th parallel north. He didn't question, how do they know that? But he thought he had truly discovered the ancestral home of the Aztecs. And that laid out this persistent narrative that the site was established by ancient Mexican people. And it is an anomalous site in Wisconsin because many of the most visible features at the site are characteristic of the Mississippian migrants who moved into Aztalan. They came probably from Illinois, probably from the St. Louis area. And so it is very different looking for Wisconsin. And so that's really helped, I think, facilitate the persistence of this myth that the site is a place of ancient Mexicans.
Oh, interesting. Are there any other myths that you're looking to bust besides that one?
Well, there's a longstanding myth that the people who lived there were cannibals. Hmm. And there's no evidence for that either. That's derived from excavations that were conducted in the 1930s. And they found a lot of broken bones, some of which was human. And they didn't think about, well, what are the things that can happen in the ground that can lead to bones being broken in different ways? They just leapt to a conclusion that the bones must have been broken, because sometimes they were found with animal bones, that they must have been broken as part of something related to eating. But animals are sometimes buried with people in the past. So there's a lot of complicated things that relate to that, but we don't see any evidence of that. And there's also been a longstanding myth that because of the wooden walls that were built around the site, that the relationship between the late woodland peoples and the Mississippian peoples was really conflict-laden. And what we're finding is that Mississippian artifacts and late woodland artifacts are commingled. They're found together in the same features, that they are even found in places where it looks like they were very intentionally placed on the floor of a house with a late woodland sherd or pottery vessel placed, and then a Mississippian sherd or vessel placed right on top of it. Hmm. And those sorts of juxtapositions of material culture that look intentional give us a clue that there's probably a more peaceful relationship between these people. And then we also see that they experimented with one another's technologies of making pottery and styles of making pottery. And the same, it looks like, with houses, the way they built their houses. So that sharing of material practices is something that is most likely going to happen in a more peaceful situation of migrants coming into a community.
You mentioned the mounds, the walls, the houses, and I know there are some recreations up at the site. Can you paint a picture of what this might have looked like if we were able to go back in time and visit Aztalan at its peak?
There would have been It would have been perhaps a little like some of the county seats in Wisconsin, where you would have had a square in this case we would call it a plaza, flanked by earthen mounds. And then around that plaza area would be houses. And they probably weren't randomly scattered. They probably were arranged in a somewhat structured manner, but we know from previous work that the entryways faced different directions. And it would have been really well populated. There would have been, 600 or more people living there. So you would have had people running around. You would have had small kitchen gardens next to houses within the site. Outside the wall, there probably were larger gardens. There would have been children, grown-ups interacting, some people making pottery, some people talking. It just would have been a really active, active place.
So just very briefly as we wrap up, we know you said that these people lived there for at least a few generations. What do we know about what happened to them?
That's a mystery that we don't have good answers to. There are a lot of different factors that were probably involved in the abandonment of the community. And one of those might have been environmental degradation. You have a large concentration of people in a small area cutting down a lot of wood that would be used to build houses and walls, but for fires as well. That may have been a factor. Another factor may have been changing social relationships with other communities. There may have been some climate changes going on around that time. We know that within 100 years of the demise of Aztalan, the climate has gotten cooler, and many peoples have abandoned the upper Great Lakes and moved to the south. And there may have been some breakdown in some of the social relationships within the community.
A lot of mysteries still to solve. Cecil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
A pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Cecil Schrader. She's a professor of anthropology at UW-Madison, looking at the ongoing work at the site in Aztalan.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, Garrison Keillor stepped down from the helm of A Prairie Home Companion after 42 years as its host and as the gentle voice of Midwestern reason and dry wit.
The music, drama, and storytelling show is a public radio centerpiece for years and an entry point for new listeners at the height of its influence. It may be a coincidence that Keillor's stepping down just as podcasting is taking off, but either way, it could mark the end of an era.
Our next guest says public radio is the victim of its own success. It had ratings and revenue benchmarks to uphold. It got overly cautious and risk-averse. Now, he says, with podcasts showing big growth potential and the media market changing, NPR has an opportunity to grow and adapt. Some critics have said it's already too late.
Adam Ragusa joins us now. He's a journalist in residence at Mercer University's Center for Collaborative Journalism, and he hosts and produces the weekly podcast The Pub for the public broadcasting trade publication Current. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be with you, Veronica. Shall we commence with examining our respective navels?
I guess that's what we're doing a little bit.
Yeah.
So do you think it's fair to say that public radio is facing a turning point right now?
Yeah. I mean, I think the retirement of Garrison is a big moment. It comes not so long after Car Talk stopped making new episodes. That show still gets syndicated and a lot of stations still air it. But one of the hosts is sadly passed on. It's all sort of recycled material right now. And there's other retirements in the works, just big institutions of public radio, kind of just going away, ending. Reaching the end of their life cycle. And that's a really, really big moment. You know, a program like Prairie Home Companion, like Car Talk, we don't necessarily think of those as being the thing when we think about public radio. Like if there's one or two programs that are the thing when we think about NPR or public radio, it's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. In our world, Veronica, we use this term called those are the tentpole programs. Those are the two things that hold up everything else, right? Those are kind of what we're here to do is Morning Edition and All Things Considered and programs like it. But programs like Car Talk and Prairie Home Companion, these weekend programs, played a very, very important role in sustaining the entire public radio system. They just are very, very popular and drive a lot of revenue. That's just sorry to be crass about it, folks, but you listening, dear listeners of Wisconsin Public Radio, those are the shows that you have historically called in to support during pledge drive as Car Talk and Prairie Home Companion and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and a few things like it, okay? It just drives money. It's also the case that those have tended to be the programs that brought people in. People sort of stumbled onto public radio by hearing Car Talk or having a friend talk about Car Talk, and that was their gateway drug into public radio. So to lose those is very, very consequential. It's also very consequential because they're massive drivers of ratings, especially Car Talk, but also in certain, I bet that in your market, Veronica, I bet that people love Prairie Home Companion. It's that whole upper Midwest WASP sensibility that probably
here.
Really speaks to your audience,
but,
right?
I mean, I suppose we have to point out that it's not going away, that it's going to be transformed with Chris Thiele, a new host,
yeah,
but
sure.
It's not really going to be the same show.
No, it is
and
not at
even,
all going to be the same
even
show.
Even Chris Thiele admits that. But so without those shows, do you think that NPR has, I mean, I guess the question is, do we need new tentpole shows to bring people in, or are there other things that public radio should be doing instead of looking for these next big shows?
I will tell you that something that has been a big topic of conversation at NPR and at any network level conversation, and even at some stations, looking for a new weekend hit. That's something that public radio at the highest levels has been talking about for a long, long time. And it's something that NPR tried to do with the launch of that quiz show. The name is escaping me now. What's the new quiz show they launched a few years ago?
There's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is still
yeah.
Ask Me Another.
Ask Me Another. Yes, that's right. Thank you. So they launched Ask Me Another. That was a very, very deliberate attempt to craft and then launch a new weekend hit for public radio. And it has only been, I don't think it's fair to call it a hit. I think it has been, it's done okay, but it's not on that many stations. They tend to not program it at really, really prominent times, and it doesn't have a massive following like Car Talk had. And to me, I also kind of can, and this is a hard thing for me to say because I have friends who participated in creating that program, but like I don't think it's that good of a show. It sounds to me to be contrived, because it is contrived. It's something where a bunch of people worked for a long time really, really hard with the deliberate aim of creating a new hit, you know, nerdy entertainment public radio weekend hit. And I just don't think that you can do that. Where did Car Talk come from? Car Talk was not the result of some committee that went into a room determined to kind of find a hit. No, Car Talk came out of the primordial soup of public radio. 45 years ago, public radio was, no one knew what it was going to be. It was just a bunch of radio stations at universities, mostly universities across the country, that were being run by hippies in their 20s who had, were just, you know, experimental people, really didn't have any kind of expectation or standard to uphold, and they just did crazy things. You know, Jane Christo, who was running the station where I used to work, WBUR in Boston, that's where Car Talk started. Jane Christo basically looked at these two, you know, working class MIT guys and said, hey, you're kind of funny. Do you want to come on the radio and talk about cars? And they did it. You know, I mean, honestly, Veronica, like if I were to pitch to you, forget the car in your head, forget that Car Talk exists for a second, right? Like, what if I were to pitch to you, hey, I think that I have an idea for a hit public radio show. Two guys with working class Boston accents taking calls on car repair. Like, does that sound like a hit public radio show to you?
Oh, I mean, yeah, in retrospect, not so
in
much
retrospect,
today.
Yeah, exactly. But like, that's what I'm talking about, is that it's like, it's not something you're going to be able to contrive. These wonderful things, you know, Prairie Home Companion too. Who would have thought that would have been a good idea? No one. It just came out of this period of experimentation where people were just throwing spaghetti against the wall, and those were the two strands that stuck because they're wonderful. But no one could have foreseen those as being hits.
Well, you mentioned the graying hippies that started public radio, or not crazy, you called them crazy hippies who started public radio. And that reminds me of this Washington Post article that ran not too long ago, talking about what they called the graying of public radio. And they talked about the decline in ratings in some of those big flagship programs you mentioned, things like All Things Considered, things like Morning Edition. Do you think those numbers are something to be worried about?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that the trend lines, the long-term trend lines for public radio listenership, and I say radio specifically, people listening over radio towers, those have been going down. Now, I will say, Veronica, that like something that we're seeing right now is that the numbers are shooting up all of a sudden. Ratings for All Things Considered, according to an internal memo that I saw recently that was written by NPR CEO Jarl Mohn, their ratings for All Things Considered, national ratings in the last ratings period spiked 40%. 40%. That's ginormous. Now, I'm a little bit skeptical about some methodological stuff that's at work in that, but certainly what's going on, where you can really attribute that is to the election. This election is bananas, and public radio listeners really, really care about it, and they are tuning into their stations in massive numbers, much more massive numbers than I would have ever expected. I predicted the death of radio a long time ago, and I've been proven wrong and wrong and wrong again. So right now, I mean, public radio people are feeling pretty good about ratings. Now, the question is that going to persist after this totally bananas election is over? Well, if we elect a bananas president, then maybe the interest will stay high for a while, and that'd be great. But I think that, you know, putting all of that aside, yes, the long term trend line is certainly down in terms of radio ratings. That's a different thing when you look at overall audience that's being served by public radio, and we know that as radio listenership goes down, we've also seen podcasts come out of nowhere, and public radio is absolutely owning the podcasting game right now. The top, you know, half of the top 20 podcasts on iTunes are generally public radio podcasts, so that's a new audience that we're growing. Web stream, right? So like right before I went live with you, I tweeted on my Twitter account that I would be going live with you, and I have a lot of friends and family who do not, you know, live in Wisconsin, and they're some of them are probably listening right now through a web stream. That web stream is not being captured by Nielsen's ratings numbers. So the rating, we actually kind of don't know how much the ratings are going down, because we know that a lot of people are listening to streaming and a lot of people are listening to podcasts. I have concerns about the overall audience declining for public radio for demographic reasons. But in terms of, like, you know, who's listening to what listening technology, I don't really think that we know if listening is going up or down.
So the evidence is hazy, Adam. And just briefly, what do you think we need to worry about in terms of, well, I guess, do we need to worry at all about the age of public radio listeners? Is that a legitimate question? You know, that eternal question, are younger people listening? Are they coming on board? Are they responding to younger hosts like Ari Shapiro, for instance?
Veronica, would you mind if I ask generally your age bracket?
I would mind very much.
Okay.
Let me tell you this. I'm public radio young. So can you guess what that means?
Yeah, I'm public radio young too.
No, okay? I think I'm slightly public radio older than that. But
neither of us are Clear Channel young. Sorry, iHeartRadio young. Okay. we're public radio young. And I bet that you have maybe gotten a few email complaints about, like, how, wow, that Veronica, she sounds so young. She's got a little bit of that vocal fry. Can you get her off, get a real person up there? I certainly have gotten those kinds of emails over the course of my career. You know, what we're seeing is that the core public radio audience has always been baby boomers. That's who it is. It's not necessarily that, like, our audience is aging. It's that our audience has always been baby boomers, and baby boomers are getting older. And that's starting to be a problem in the sense that baby boomers have these really particular values and aesthetic interests that and their use, but baby boomers as a demo have been used to having their needs catered to their entire freaking lives, okay? And they're not used to having to share things with other people. And you and I are trying to, like, make radio and make stuff that is going to be exciting to people our age and younger, but the aesthetic gulf between what we're going to do for them and what the baby boomers are expecting is widening. And we're, I think, increasingly having trouble serving both people, serving our core historic audience of baby boomers, but also creating stuff that's going to appeal to younger people. And that's a serious challenge.
We're talking with Adam Ragusa right now about the future of public radio in a new media era as a Prairie Home Companion, one of public radio's powerhouse shows, undergoes a transformation Without Garrison Keillor. Adam is a journalist in residence at Mercer University, and he hosts and produces the weekly podcast called The Pub.
And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you want from public radio in the future? Are there changes you think are overdue, or do you want more of the same? Do you include podcasts in your listening habits these days? If you're listening to us live, is it on a radio of some sort or on a high-tech device? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Adam Ragusa right now about the future of public radio. Adam is a journalist in residence at Mercer University, and he hosts and produces the weekly podcast, The Pub.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you like about public radio? What would you like to change? What do you wish had not changed? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our first caller now. We've got Linda on the line in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi. I'm part of the target audience. I'm a baby boomer.
Okay.
And I like it because it's a refuge and an intelligent conversations, especially Wisconsin public radio. But my daughter, who's a millennial, it's one of her favorite stations. It started as classical music when she was a baby. And then it went from classical music to Chapter a Day, another WPR original, to Prairie Home Companion, you know. What?
So your daughter grew up listening, and now she's a public radio listener, which I have to say is what happened with me, too, and now I work in public radio. So, Adam, is that one way it works, that one generation passes it on to the next, the public radio listening bug?
Yeah, that's historically how it has worked, and maybe that will keep us going to a certain point. But, I mean, it's also the case that America is just getting to be a much more diverse place, and public radio, I don't think, can thrive on the historically white upper middle class audience that has been its core for its history, nor do I think that can it really fulfill its mission only speaking to that audience. I mean, what is the point of public broadcasting? It's spelled out right in the Public Broadcasting Act from 1968 that which specifically mentions that we're supposed to be serving underserved demographics. And so if we're only kind of passing public radio along from parent to child, we're not going to branch out into emerging America that we really should be serving.
I want to ask you about something you said. I hope you don't mind my sharing in an email when we talked about what we were going to talk about today. You said that...
No, I don't mind that at all.
Okay. So you said that public radio did have an opportunity now. You've been predicting the end of radio, but you think public radio has an opportunity to thrive, to change, to grow. And here's the part that... people might be interested in hearing. You said, as long as public radio listeners calm down and stop acting like scalded cats when there's a change. So are the listeners part of the problem here? Is this the scalded cat phenomenon?
Yeah, and
part
I can
of
say that
because
I don't work in public radio anymore. Like I'm a academia fat cat, you know, so I don't have to kind of live with the consequences that I'm about to say like you do, Veronica, you know, which is that, like, yeah, I mean, this is something that public radio stations have dealt with forever, which is that if you make the slightest change, like a smart program director looks at some numbers and says, listen, I think that Wait, Don't Tell Me could do a little bit better at 11 o'clock than it's doing at 10 o'clock. I'm going to move it, man. It's the rabble will surround the station with pitchforks and demand the heads of that program director. It's insane, okay? And that's, to a certain extent, that speaks to something really wonderful, which is that radio and audio more generally, podcasts do this too, really works its way into the rhythms of our life, the rituals of our life. And we come to really depend on it to be there for us when we mow the lawn every Saturday or whatever it is that we do when we listen to that particular show. So I know why people get so connected to it. But if you care about this, dear, I'm speaking to you, listener, directly right now. If you care about this institution, if you care about Wisconsin Public Radio, man, please ease up on them. Like they need to do some things that are are a lot more dramatic than move wait from 10 to 11, okay, in order to figure out what public radio is going to be and should be in the 21st century. So please cut them some slack, try to work with them, bear with them, and recognize, especially older listeners, you know, that the kinds of programming that they're going to need to be developing are not necessarily things that are going to speak to you. And I hope that you can just think about Wisconsin Public Radio not just as something that serves you, but as a common community resource, something that's supposed to make life better for everyone around you, and support it on that basis, even if it starts to move in directions that aesthetically or content-wise are things that don't really appeal to you.
Let's grab another call now. We've got Dag with us in Ashland. Hi, Dag.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I wanted to marry two of the concepts your guest put together, nerdiness and contrived, into contrived nerdiness.
Yeah.
And it just dominates now. It's like whatever, Ira Glass, This American Life has just become miserable. Now there's like this whole plethora of shows like Moth Radio Hour, where there's this wide-eyed little boy pretense.
Dang.
So,
all right, so Dag, not a fan of some shows or some tones. I don't know. What do you hear when you hear a comment like that, Adam?
I hear something that I think I share. I mean, I think This American Life is a phenomenal show. It is extraordinarily important, and it still, you know, pound for pound, I think, fulfills the mission of public radio better than anything else that's out there. But it's so good that it has spawned so many imitators, people trying to imitate that very, very peculiar aesthetic. And that's not so good. But it's also the case that I think that part of that is what we were talking about earlier, Veronica, which is that public radio has just been playing it safe for 40 years. And, you know, if it looked and smelled like something that's already been a public radio hit, they thought, well, this might do well on public radio too. And that's where I think you've been getting this kind of self-similarity in the product. And I think that as especially with the birth, with podcasting becoming so exciting and so vibrant, you're getting institutions out there taking more chances and basically saying, hey, you kid, I don't understand what your thing is, but you seem to have something neat going on. Why don't you try making a show? It can just go on the internet. You're not going to do too much damage there. And then we'll see what comes of it. And we're seeing really cool things come of it.
Well, let's talk about that podcasting thing, because on the one hand, it seems like a great opportunity. On another, we've heard critiques from people saying that NPR hasn't moved fast enough on podcasting, been aggressive enough, and that it may have already lost the ball game. What do you say to that?
I don't think that that particular critique is true, and that's a critique that's been made by my friend Adam Davidson, who used to be an economics reporter for NPR, and I agree with Adam on a lot of things. I don't think that NPR has been too slow to embrace podcasting, but you know what folks need to understand is that there's a sensitivity here. The public radio system that is all a bunch of these NPR member stations like Wisconsin Public Radio that then support NPR, it depends on the primacy of over-the-air radio. When people listen to programs directly through the internet, it kind of threatens the entire organizational structure and the economy of public radio in a way that is sensitive for NPR to try to handle, and that's just something that we're going to have to negotiate. The one thing, and that's really inside baseball for people to understand. I don't think you need to really understand it that much, though. Feel free to listen to my show and hear all about it every week. The one thing that I think listeners do need to think about is that it has been the primacy of radio and Wisconsin Public Radio being an intermediary for getting that NPR news out of Washington in Madison or wherever you are in Wisconsin. That relationship has been what has essentially subsidized all of the local programming that Wisconsin Public Radio does. This show right now, Central Time, in effect being subsidized by that relationship, all of the local reporting. And as people start to listen to stuff directly through the internet and not through the radio, I'm worried about how local programming in places like Wisconsin is going to be sustained financially. And so I just hope that everyone thinks about that and is aware of that dynamic when Pledge Drive comes around.
Adam, we leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Adam Ragusa, journalist in residence at Mercer University's Center for Collaborative Journalism. He hosts and produces the weekly podcast, The Pub, for the public broadcasting trade publication, Current. And don't forget, you can weigh in on this. How do you feel about the future of public radio? Do you think NPR and public radio in general are well poised? Are you going to keep listening? What about the next generation? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's the end of an era that a lot of us probably thought it was already over. The Japanese company Funai Electric announced that at the end of this month, it will stop making VCRs. And they're the last company, apparently, that was still making them.
That's news to me. It's mostly because I had no idea anyone was still making VCRs. Apparently, that company sold 750,000 VCRs last year. Not enough to make it worthwhile, apparently, to keep going. At its peak, though, the company alone sold 15 million VCRs a year.
Yeah, so unsurprisingly, VCR sales have plummeted. I'm not sure why. The DVDs and then the web streaming and things like that. But, I remember, I'll show my age here as public radio young. I remember when we first got VCRs, and it was this incredible thing. All of a sudden, you didn't have to watch TV at that time or you missed it forever.
Well, I remember not just renting, the video itself. Mm-hmm. I remember renting the VCR.
Right, yeah.
From the drugstore. Right.
Yeah, we had a party store, corner store, you call it here, that rented, had two racks of videotapes and then the VCR you could rent.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. DVDs are just easier. I'd like to be nostalgic for the VCR, but I'm not. I'm just not.
DVD? What's that?
Yeah, well, right.
That's on the way out next.
No one does DVDs anymore either.
All right. Celebrating the demise of technology, this is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.